The Sunstone Foundation presents The Thematics of Reading and Writing in the Book of Mormon, recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Fred Pinneger will be delivering the paper, and I'd like to just give you a little information about him. He is currently in the process of finishing his doctoral dissertation in American literature at the University of Arizona. And he received his bachelor's and his master's degree from Brigham Young University. He's taught literature, composition, business writing, technical writing, courses at BYU, Purdue, and the University of Arizona. His wife, Stephanie, is also completing her doctoral degree in educational psychology at the University of Arizona. And they have two children, Eliza and Mark. Is that correct? Okay. Following Fred Pinneger's presentation of his paper, we'll hear comments from Stephen Walker. Stephen Walker is currently at Brigham Young University. He's professor of English and graduate coordinator. Before that, he taught at Harvard from 1969 to 1972, where he received his PhD in English. Is that correct? Okay. He and his wife, Ardith, have three children, Scott, Rebecca, and Emily. Thank you.
Is this on?
If you have trouble hearing me, please let me know. This is an echo chamber. My paper is on the thematics of reading and writing in the Book of Mormon. Thematics is a term which is used by Edgar Dryden, a literary critic, and it simply refers to the theme or the ideas associated with reading and writing. Among other things, the Book of Mormon is a document about reading and writing, about the production and consumption of text. As it is presented in Mormon's abridgment, the gospel is a preeminently textualized experience. People in the Book of Mormon who are seeking religious truth typically find it through inquiry into sacred texts. Have ye not read, Nephi asks his brothers? And they come to understand the fullness of the gospel message through further careful study of the same books. Ultimately, the record of one's adherence to the commandments is textualized in God's record of man on earth, the Book of Life. And we are judged according to our adherence to a set of concepts which is outlined in a written format. In short, we are a people who derive their identity from a sacred book. To many people in the church, both ancient and modern, these books represent the inscription of self-evident truth. To question this self-evidentness has often been equated with heresy and apostasy, as when the Jews are described in Jacob 4:14 as looking beyond the mark. But there are a number of problematic features associated with reading and writing in the Book of Mormon, which should be examined and analyzed closely. One of the problems associated with the Book of Mormon is that its ellipsis, compression, and conflation are often mistaken for prolixity and excrescence in the writing. This is a great paradox. For many people coming to the Book of Mormon for the first time, the Book of Mormon presents a number of perplexing problems in reading. It goes on endlessly and seems to get sidetracked with annoying frequency into pointless subplots. However, as we become more aware of the complex way in which various authorial voices are embedded and framed, and as we recognize that brief periods of time receive inordinate attention while vast stretches of chronology are left entirely blank, much of the initial confusion goes away. Still, we should not think of the Book of Mormon as a Reader's Digest version of Nephite history. For it is not a dehydrated boiling down of the original records, nor is it a summary of them. Rather, the rhetorical terms ellipsis, compression, and conflation, which I have used above, are suggestive of a poetic sparseness. John Sorensen says that what most people mean by history is a sequential record of significant events affecting a people or nation. Yet the Book of Mormon contains mainly sermons, letters, and other writings of religious intent. All this is strung together in a chronological scheme that many readers never really get straight. This is an odd kind of history. The Book of Mormon further makes it clear at several points that there was a relatively large amount of writing going on among the people of Lehi. Joseph and Oliver, for example, were shown a whole library of ancient records when they returned the plates upon completion of their translation work. And Mormon himself speaks several times of his difficulty in selecting and choosing from what is available to him as he works on his abridgment. For example, he talks about stumbling on a group of plates. After I had made an abridgment from the plates of Nephi down to the reign of this Benjamin, of whom Amalekai spake, I searched among the records which had been delivered into my hands, and I found these plates, which contained this small account of the prophets from Jacob down to the reign of this King Benjamin, and also many of the words of Nephi. Similarly, when Moroni is working on the record of Ether, he says that he has not included 1/100th part of what was available. So while we have about 31 pages of text concerning Ether, he had something like the equivalent of 3,100 from which to extract his account, if we can assume that he is not exaggerating. Furthermore, Nephi indicates that his father's record, the lost 116 manuscript pages of the book of Lehi, is a more complete, more interesting record than his own. A further suggestion of plenitude is indicated by comments about other records that were written which might be made available to us at a future date. The so-called sealed portion of the plates Joseph had in his possession and to which reference is made. Statements are also present about books written for the benefit and use of other people. Wherefore, because that ye have a Bible, ye need not suppose that it contains all of my words. Neither need ye suppose that I have not caused more to be written. For I have commanded all men, both in the east and in the west, and in the north and in the south, and in the islands of the sea, that they shall write the words which I speak unto them. For out of the books which shall be written, I will judge the world, every man according to his works, according to that which is written. Clearly, the writing of sacred records was a widespread industry, and the implication seems to be that the records of other religions of the world were written under inspiration for the benefit of those who received them. Typically, it is argued among Mormons that world religions are the result of apostasy and the inevitable corruption of true religion that comes about when the gift of prophecy is lost. Furthermore, these corrupt religions seem to have little or nothing to do with the gospel of Jesus Christ. I would argue, however, that what is right for us may not necessarily be right for others. The Book of Mormon, for example, is very explicit in its prohibition against polygamy because, as it says in Jacob 2, the people were inappropriate in their practice of it. But plural marriage was allowed among the Old Testament patriarchs and for a short time in the latter days. Consequently, it stands to reason that there can be a great deal of variation between religions, which is designed for the capacity of a specific culture to hear and obey. The first principles, faith, repentance, some kind of redemptive process, baptism, an initiation process, and the Holy Ghost, a process of inspiration and revelation, seem to be operational in all world religions, persuading good men everywhere to believe in a higher law and obey it. If God speaks to an individual through Muhammad or Buddha, or some other prophet, that is the voice he should heed until, quote, one mightier than I comes along, as John the Baptist says in Matthew 3:11. For out of the books which shall be written, God will judge the world, as it says in 2 Nephi. Since this sounds chauvinistic, I would also hasten to point out that the so-called chosen people are paradoxically often the least likely candidates in terms of faithfulness and obedience. Despite this plenitude of records and abundant references to writing and reading, there are many suggestions that literacy was not universal, and that oral traditions were an important part of both the Lamanite and Nephite cultures. In John L. Sorensen's discussion of an ancient American setting for the Book of Mormon, he asserts that an important requirement for the localizing of a Book of Mormon geography is social and cultural characteristics. Any area proposed as the Nephite Promised Land must meet certain cultural requirements. For example, the ancient inhabitants must have been literate with a long tradition of keeping extensive records. Literacy, however, should not necessarily be construed here as meaning that a large majority of the population could read and write. The Old and New Testaments, as well as the Book of Mormon, show many signs of oral conventions, and there is a good deal of sliding between spoken and written discourse. In 1 Nephi, there are statements about individuals reading to groups of people. Nephi says, "I did read many things to them," and similar cases can be found elsewhere. "I will read you the words of Isaiah. I have read you these things that you might know. Now I read unto you the remainder of the commandments." And Mosiah did read and cause to be read the records of Zenith to his people. For some investigators, these kinds of references are taken as an indication that there was an elite ruling class of literate warrior priests like Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni who could read and write, while the majority or a significantly large part of the general population could not. It is also possible that there was a class of scribes who did much of the writing and reading in a basically oral culture, which was extremely typical in ancient times. Jeremiah 1:14, for example, makes a bleak reference to such activity. "Upon the other plates of Nephi, the records of our wars are engraved according to the writings of the kings, or those which they caused to be written." King Benjamin, too, caused that the words which he spake should be written and sent forth among those that were not under the sound of his voice, that they might also receive, note here that he doesn't say read, but receive his words. The concept of a book, as we now know it, is so prevalent that we must constantly remind ourselves of the revolution created not only by the printing press, but by the rotary press as well. For while the former made the printed word readily available to those who could afford it, the latter, the rotary press, flooded the globe starting in the 1840s with low-cost reading material appropriately adjusted to the taste and capacity of the new reading public. Some of the narrator's discussions in the Book of Mormon about the inadequacy of their writing skill may be linked to a perception common during the transition from an oral to a written society that writing is a lesser activity than remembering. Jan Swearingen, in Oral Hermeneutics During the Transition to Literacy, notes that for Plato, the highest forms of knowledge, and most of all, understanding, cannot be transmitted by or reduced to writing. At best, writing only replicates or serves as a mnemonic for what is already there. At worst, because it is so seductively tangible, it weakens the mind and causes a confusion of knowledge and information with wisdom and understanding. Whether or not these speculations are so, it is clear that oral discourse was an important medium, perhaps even the main vehicle, for teaching and learning, as well as recording the past. Enos, for example, heard about the gospel from his father rather than discovered it in a book. And there are many references to formal and informal speech occasions from homiletics to political and propaganda speeches to complex theological discourses. Arthur Henry King says that much is lost in reading Scripture privately and silently to ourselves rather than hearing it read out loud in a family setting or in a group of people. Still, while it is clear that oral traditions can preserve accurate history, literate societies tend to privilege the written word and written records. The people of Zarahemla, for example, are depicted as having degenerated largely because of their failure to bring with them records like the plates of brass carried by Lehi's people. Moreover, alternative etiological myths, one oral and the other written, were at the root of the unending wars between the Lamanites and the Nephites. The oral record is the foolish tradition of the Lamanite fathers, often mentioned in the book. Past events exist only as texts, whether those texts are oral or written. And the very act of putting experience into story is already an act of interpretation. There is no such thing as a fact speaking unambiguously for itself, as some would have us believe. There are constant references in the prophetic and visionary writings to the Lord commanding his seers to write things down. This textualizing or putting experience into writing is depicted in the Book of Mormon as a way of establishing and preserving truth. It is an attempt to give material presence to the apparent absence of God. Gayatri Spivak, in his translator's preface to Derrida's A Grammatology, says that humankind's common desire is for a stable center, for the assurance of mastery through knowing or possessing. And a book, with its ponderable shape and its beginning, middle, and end, stands to satisfy that desire. There is still, however, an illusory quality to the truth established by the written word. Nephi and the other storytellers in the Book of Mormon understood the necessity of turning experience into a story if they were to face and survive the horrible truth implicit in experience. That is, that the nature of free agency is such that man is left terribly alone, even with an idea of personal revelation operational here. He is left terribly alone to work out his own problems. The attempted reconciliation between man's desire for the full presence of God with the fact of his orphan existence is foregrounded through the entire book and epitomized at the end by Moroni, who keeps digging up the record and writing in it to say, look at me, I'm still alive. Writing is a way to keep from dying. To stop writing is to die. To stop reading or to lose one's books or records is to die. For the Book of Mormon narrators, memory is an imaginative act which makes the present a moment of creative understanding of a past adventure that was experienced initially as an unintelligible and frightening chaos of sensations. At the time of writing, think of the Joseph Smith story here, he didn't write that down, you know, when he got back to his home. That's something that was encoded years later. At the time of writing, often years after the original experience, the mature writer fictionalizes his earlier experience in an attempt to define its truth or meaning to himself and to his readers. It is the creative remembering in the present which gives meaning to the past. The emphasis, in other words, is on the act of remembering rather than on the content of memory. Thus, Nephi's account is not the diary of a youth, as it is sometimes taken to be, but rather a highly sophisticated and subtle treatise written some 30 years after the fact by a warrior statesman priest. It is furthermore one which is an apology in the classical sense, to justify or explain his actions, which might easily be misunderstood. The killing of Laban, stealing the plates and the other sacred relics twice, kidnapping Zoram, and violating the laws of primogeniture to usurp political power. While the textualizing process used in the Book of Mormon is usually seen in a somewhat naive manner as simply the straightforward recording of obvious factual information or events to which the writers were witnesses, again, this notion is problematized by the fact that the very process of putting events into a narrative is already an interpretive act. There are aesthetic considerations which should be recognized beyond an understanding of the manner of prophesying among the Jews, which is the current focus of attention by several LDS scholars. Part of this aesthetic is associated with the oral component mentioned earlier. Still, there is a good deal of quibbling and ambiguity over whether the written or spoken word is a better medium for articulating the things of the Spirit. Aesthetics, of course, refers to the rhetorical strategies and the perception of what constitutes good writing. Among Book of Mormon writers, there is a general feeling of personal inadequacy concerning writing, either because it has already been written better elsewhere. We can talk about Harold Bloom's anxiety of influence here. Because people will laugh at their weakness in writing, or because of difficulties associated with production. That is to say, you know, putting those figures onto metallic plates. Is plain and precious truth the so-called plain style? Much of the self-consciousness about adequacy can be linked to the oral literature problem, as I said. Moses was given judgment in writing, but the Lord would not loosen his tongue that he shall speak much, for I will not make him mighty in speaking. Conversely, Nephi says that he is not mighty in writing, as he is in speaking. For when a man speaketh by the power of the Holy Ghost, the power of the Holy Ghost carrieth it unto the hearts of the children of men. Finally, there is a certain category of knowledge which cannot or should not be written. It is not just a matter of lack of space. In 1 Nephi, Nephi says, I am forbidden that I should write the remainder of the things which I saw and heard. And later, there is a similar expression. Mine eyes have beheld great things, yea, even too great for man. Therefore, I was bidden that I should not write them. These kinds of statements beg the question of why the articulation of these things would be dangerous. Nietzsche is helpful here in Beyond Good and Evil, where he says something might be true while being harmful and dangerous in the highest degree. Indeed, it might be a basic characteristic of existence that those who would know it completely would perish. In which case, the strength of a spirit should be measured according to how much of the truth one could still barely endure, to put it more clearly, to what degree one would require it to be thinned down, shrouded, sweetened, blunted, or falsified. Many of the problems of Book of Mormon readers, both Mormon and Gentile, can be traced to a failure to recognize varieties of and variations within genre. The writers themselves distinguish between different kinds of writing, especially between the types of writing that go into the sacred text as opposed to other texts. And it is easy to recognize a number of familiar genres, modes, images, motifs, and themes without recourse to Hebrew poetics. And I omit here a lengthy discussion of those genres. The early reviewers of the Book of Mormon were like those of Melville's contemporaneous novel, Moby Dick. Since neither one of these works fit into a recognizable genre, they were difficult to comprehend. As Shakespeare's Falstaff says, why, she's neither fish nor flesh. A man knows not where to have her. And the sexual metaphor here is, of course, explicit. Melville remained incomprehensible and largely unread until the development of theoretical paradigms in the 20th century, which suggested a methodology for apprehending his work. To most secular scholars who have made the inquiry, the Book of Mormon remains incomprehensible except in the genre of the literary hoax, or more specifically, fictional history written to be read as real history. The hoax was a rather popular genre during the Romantic period in English and American literature. The Ossian epic of Macpherson, for example, had great influence on contemporary literature in England and in Germany, especially on Goethe, even though it was soon revealed as a fraud. It was supposed to have been written by one of the ancient Norse. Similarly, Poe in America published a number of hoaxes, such as the newspaper story now called The Great Balloon Hoax, which was originally printed in the New York Sun as a matter of fact. Does the book have aesthetic or literary value? Even some careful Mormon readers seem to have moments of doubt or initial confusion when they first approach the text. Arthur Henry King says, "It took me a long time to appreciate the Book of Mormon. When I started reading it, I thought it was an awful bore." Negative reviews, however, are more common among readers who have an axe to grind against the church. In a review of Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History, Bernard DeVoto said, "She endows the Book of Mormon with an integrated, carefully wrought structure and subtle, eloquent, and moving English style." Actually, the Gold Bible has neither form nor structure of any kind. Its imagination is worse than commonplace. It is squalid, and the prose is lethal. The book Smith wrote is not a novel to any literary critic. Similar appraisals of its content are easy to find. Mark Twain called it chloroform in print, apparently punning on the word ether. Gordon Fraser, writing in 1964, says, "The fact that the Book of Mormon is void of any literary content, credible history, biography, romance, or ethical teaching assures us that it will not be read or analyzed in a thoughtful manner. Hence, there is little danger of the average reader studying it to the point of arriving at an opinion as to its credibility." Clearly, none of these negative assessments is the result of detailed analysis of the book on its own terms, but rather the result of pre-existing religious, political, or aesthetic biases and the imposition of a Jamesian aesthetic of what constitutes proper novelistic form. One does not have to believe the book to be divinely inspired to recognize its literary traits and qualities any more than one must be a Roman Catholic to appreciate the merits of Dante's Divine Comedy or a Protestant to appreciate Paradise Lost. Richard Bushman notes that the book has, by any standard, a narrative of unusual complexity, and it recognizes that the multiplicity of stories and characters, as well as embedded layers of voices interacting, mixing, and competing in the book, create a complicated narrative perspective. Almost always, two minds are present, and sometimes three, all kept account of in the flow of words. Bushman also discusses the major criticisms of the book, both contemporary and modern, and notes that the most serious failing in all the critiques is an inability to deal with the text in any detail. But he adds further that Mormon critics also have had difficulty grasping the real intellectual problem of the Book of Mormon, the representation of another world in many ways alien to our own. Most of the writing currently being done on the Book of Mormon is focused on defending points of theology or defining parallels between the Book of Mormon and life in the ancient Near East. Although it is customary for missionaries, Sunday school teachers, and seminary instructors to flip to Moroni 10 for a pat answer about how to read and interpret the Book of Mormon, the complex problems of reading the book are illuminated very tellingly by examining the literal and figurative relationship between reading and the motifs associated with Joseph's obtaining of the sacred relics. The breastplate, the Urim and Thummim, and sword of Laban, and so on. Why were these objects in the stone box with the plates? What is the point of having the witnesses testify about them besides the fact that the objects were there? Let me suggest just a few relationships. The fact that the sacred relics were inside a stone box on a hill under a rock can be linked to similar situations in scripture and literature. Note scriptural analogs with other hills or mountains and with other configurations of sacred containers or spaces like the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies in ancient and modern temples. In symbolic terms, this configuration seems to suggest that hidden or esoteric knowledge is not to be obtained except through personal revelation, obedience, and hard work. Thus, the key to the treasure here is the treasure. In the sense that possession of knowledge about how personal revelation works is more important than possession of the original plates. The breastplate with the Urim and Thummim suggests the necessity of interpretation of Scripture. Thank you. Truth is never self-evident, as I've said, but rather dependent upon a theoretical approach. Your theoretical approach here determines everything. The devices which were given to the brother of Jared by the Lord are a concrete representation of the interpretive process. Joseph Smith apparently ultimately arrived at the point where he no longer needed the material things, the Urim and Thummim, to help him because he could see through a spiritually enlightened eye. The interpretive process, however, was still operational, as it always is for everyone in all reading. Where are the absent plates now? Gil Mortimer notes in her essay on significant absences, Faulkner's rhetoric of loss, that Faulkner's use of absent things and events as causative agents means that not happening, not knowing, and not seeing or hearing are important events in their own right. I would suggest that the question about the present whereabouts of the plates is the wrong question to ask. Joseph Smith went into the grove that spring day with a similar kind of ontological question, which church is true, but he emerged with a more important epistemological answer concerning personal revelation. The absence of the plates is like the apparent absence of God. For an individual who has made the material presence of things his God, this absence is a fatal flaw. But as Mortimer reminds us, like all symbolizations, writing fills a space both physically, the pages of a book, the space occupied by a sculpture, and psychically, the need or absence that prompted the creativity in the first place. Its presence thus, paradoxically, both substitutes something for the loss, undoing it or compensating for it as a loss, and serves as a trace, reminder, or symbol of the lost entity. It is both comforting and a reminder of the need for comfort. The voice from the dust is also a significant metaphor. For many LDS people, the Book of Mormon literally remains buried in the dust of their shelves. But reading it requires more than coming to know the stories. The stories are the least interesting part of the Book of Mormon. And infinitely more provocative is the complex and diabolic image of that voice as one who hath a familiar spirit speaking to us from out of the dust. This is in 2 Nephi. Does that decentered, chthonic, metaphoric representation of the Book of Mormon suggest the words of the old primary song, "The golden plates lay hidden deep in a mountainside, until God found one faithful in whom he could confide"? I'm sure we could sing this. "A record made by Nephi, a godly man of old." Now in the Book of Mormon, the story is retold. Now is that what that voice speaking from the dust as one who hath a familiar spirit suggests? Or does it suggest something more horrific, like what Laman and Lemuel and Lehi read on the Liahona that made them quake with fear? So here I'm suggesting that there is a horrific or awe-inspiring element of the Book of Mormon which is overlooked or bypassed or subverted even by the proliferation of stories from the Book of Mormon designed and produced for children. Conclusion. The Book of Mormon is Mormon's meta-commentary on his people, a story a group tells to itself about itself, a reading of its experience, and an interpretive reenactment of its experience. This is from Turner. And within that story is a bleak picture of human possibility, which is seldom interrupted by beatific vision. Here is a world where the inhabitants are not at home, where peace and restful existence is not possible. The time passed away with us, and also our lives passed away, like as it were unto us a dream, we being a lonesome and a solemn people, wanderers cast out from Jerusalem, born in tribulation, in a wilderness, and hated of our brethren, which caused wars and contentions, wherefore we did mourn out our days. Nothing could be closer to Macbeth's speech about life being a tale told by an idiot and signifying nothing than Moroni's statement in Mormon 8. "And my father also was killed by them, and I even remain alone to write the sad tale of the destruction of my people." He entered the records one last time to say, "I will write and hide up the records in the earth, and whither I go it mattereth not. I have not friends nor whither to go. And how long the Lord will suffer that I may live, I know not." Men seek the still center of ontological stability. That is the essence of religion and of philosophy and of science, too. But that center never holds. Only in brief moments of poetic defiance, "Oh, that I were an angel," do we see a breaking of this dominant existential vision of isolation, despair, loneliness, and entrapment by the creation of an otherworldly vision and assurances of celestial order. But those moments are illusory and lack development as a fully articulated ethos, 3 Nephi notwithstanding. Quotation is always breaking the surface to call attention to a prophet or time in the past or the future and to a lost ideal order. But the context of the quote always reveals that things were no better then. Those features of narrative which render it symbolically meaningful, closure and completion, are absent from the Book of Mormon narrative. Or rather, they are projected onto the future in an attempt to capture and hold it in the face of irrecoverable loss in the present. Mormon's achievement in the Book of Mormon is like that of Ishmael in Moby Dick. It is the result, as Edgar Dryden says, of a victory of art over life, finding the natural world a place which at first enchants, then confuses and terrifies, and recognizing that human constructs fail to explain or control it, he removes himself from both nature and society by retreating to a fanciful world of his own creation. He does this by displacing history to another time and another place in order to assert control over the future, since the past is irretrievably lost. Properly then, the Book of Mormon does not end with Moroni 10:34, but rather with the narratives of Joseph Smith. They're put at the front of the book. They should be at the end. It should be at the end of the book because that is where the narrative continues. With the narratives, the collection of narratives of Joseph Smith confronting God to demand wisdom, his recovery of the plates, and his recovery of the forgotten epistemology of personal revelation. Nor, however, does it end there either, for Joseph Smith, too, forces us into continuing revelations contained in the Doctrine and Covenants. And those statements force us back into the Old and New Testament. In short, it doesn't end, and that's the point. There is a sense that the people of the Book of Mormon, like the people today, found the gospel boring and uninteresting, if not irrelevant. This is the problem of church members just going inactive rather than joining other churches. Counter-religion in the Book of Mormon is almost always represented not as the presence of an attractive competing theology, but rather of atheism, agnosticism, apathy, or ignorance. The concern of missionaries and prophets in the Book of Mormon is not that the people will be seduced by other religions, but rather that they will simply forget or fail to understand. Perhaps this problem is part of the reason why the Book of Mormon is as difficult as it is. Roland Barthes, in Pleasures of the Text, defines the text of pleasure as the text that contents, fills, grants euphoria, the text that comes from culture and does not break with it. In other words, the one that makes us feel good about ourselves. This is linked to the comfortable practice of reading. The text of bliss, however, which is an awkward translation of a French term referring to sexual pleasure, however, the kind that Barth advocates is the text that imposes a state of loss, the text that discomforts, perhaps to the point of a certain boredom, unsettles the reader's historical, cultural, psychological assumptions, the consistency of his tastes, values, memories, brings to a crisis his relation with language. Ultimately, then, if we read the Book of Mormon for its stories, for the plot, it will be nothing to us but a book of stories for children, rather than the kind of profound and perhaps horrific confrontation with our culture, our heritage, our theology, our God, and ourselves that it should be. Thank you.
And thank you, Fred. I think we've little enough time left, about 20 minutes. But rather than read my rebuttal speech, brilliant though that speech is, every word a gem, it might be better for me, with Fred's and with Michelle's permission, to simply lead out in asking some questions. That way we can kill two birds with one stone in these final few minutes. I see the symposium as a chance not simply to sit at the feet of the wise, much as I appreciate the wisdom of the wise, but for us to exchange perspectives. And the past Sunstone experiences, and there have been some fine ones that I've enjoyed, the questions are the best part. So let's question. I suspect I speak for all of us when I thank Fred, express to him my appreciation for his presentation. To see the Book of Mormon whole, to see it as it really is, we do need to look at it from every possible perspective. And Fred's perspective is, for most of us, a new way of looking at it, and therefore a potentially illuminating perspective. My first question is, how actually illuminating is this perspective? Granted that we ought to turn the Book of Mormon every which way we can, how good is this way? Let me define that a little bit. I have a couple of hesitations about the view. The first is that seeing the world textually, seeing the world in terms of thematics, has become a fashionable thing to do. Can anyone here say fashionable the way Church Lady on Saturday Night Live used to do? I'd like to say fashionable, like that. In other words, I use the term derogatively. Fashionable as in 1950s beehive hairdos or 60s bell-bottom trousers or 80s studied sloppinesses, like my daughters spend half an hour every morning putting the wrinkles just right in their blouses. That kind of fashionable. Is the view of Book of Mormon, yeah, precisely. Is the view of the Book of Mormon as an exercise in reading and writing merely fashionable, or does it have lasting power for us? Does it have, do you think, real substance? Is there anything to these new clothes that we see the king wearing? That is to say, at base, is the view accurate? Does the Book of Mormon go out of its way to textualize itself? Are Book of Mormon people, are we, as a Book of Mormon people, people of the book, or are we rather people of the experience? Are we readers, or are we doers? Are we not as a people, and perhaps happily so, far better and more frequent readers of the book that is life than we are of the book that is the Book of Mormon? Translators of stories into experience rather than translators of experience into stories. Let me give you just a couple of examples. You point to Moroni, who quote, keeps digging up the record to say, look at me, I'm still alive. Isn't it more accurate to say that in that long last, what was it, 20, 22 years of his life, Moroni does remarkably little digging up of the record. 12 pages worth, about, as I recall, 10 or 12, maybe 15 at the outside. You've got it there, you could double check me. But as I read it, at most 3 diggings up, maybe only 1 in 2 decades. In another part you suggest, and I like the way you put it, writing is a way to keep from dying. To stop writing is to die. To stop reading or to lose one's books is to die. I just ask, much as I love the rhetoric of all that, is it for us, really? Or is it simply just to become a little less literarily involved when we lose our books? You suggest that Mormon's achievement in the Book of Mormon is like that of Ishmael and Moby Dick. It's the result of a victory of art over life. Would Mormon agree with that estimate? And would you really? I'm a literary person, a professor of literature, but I what I'm asking is, are we making more claims for literariness here than the Book of Mormon can hold up under? Is the book as literary? Is it as textualizing? Is it as focused on thematics as your suggesting here? And do we even want it to be? In other words, are you putting us on? Is this just an intellectual exercise, or are you a real believer in the position?
Is that the end?
Yeah.
I'd like to add more to say. We have 20 minutes.
Yeah, I've got other questions. I really just want to interact with you and let the group.
Okay, thematics as a fad. I haven't read anything like this. I've always been disappointed that the literary critics in the church have not done more writing. There was a fad, speak of fads here, a couple of years ago, which is still in effect, concerning discussions of typology of the Book of Mormon, which I found interesting for about a year, but then I thought they were a little reductive. I'm not sure that we can escape from fad and fashion in any context. For example, Mormonism right now, this will surprise you, is fashionable, largely because we've bought into capitalistic materialism. I can see when we practiced polygamy, we weren't popular at all, but when we abandoned that practice and allowed ourselves to be absorbed into mainstream America, we became fashionable. The church expanded and blew out of the seams. But everything is fashion, so I'm not sure.
But you really believe in fashion. You're really into it. You're persuaded.
This
is a legitimate way to read the book.
Yes,
when you talk about fashion, are you talking about higher criticism?
I'm talking about thematics per se, which really is. We're on the cutting edge here of literary fashion. Fred has into the Book of Mormon the most recent and the best, I think, things that are being done in literary criticism. What I'm asking is if those things really apply, if they're really valuable in the long run.
I see contemporary criticism as simply a tool for opening up the text. And what I see frequently coming out of, this is not a personal affront, but coming out of from BYU professors and discussing the Book of Mormon is a too much time arguing against contemporary philosophy or contemporary critical theory, rather than pointing out all the problems. There are problems. I quote Nietzsche in here. You know, I mean, obviously, to Mormons, there are lots of problems with Nietzsche, but his quotation seems to be so, you know, useful. In fact, in my gospel doctrine classes, I refer to him as Apostle Nietzsche. And a lot of people think that he really is. But I think that, you know, that misreading has some value, and that we ought to, you know, use more of the tools that are being made available to us to open up and probe and find ways of talking about, you know, the text, talking about the Book of Mormon, for example, rather than shutting it down. And the thing about Mormon digging up the record is was an unfortuitous statement. Nearly all of the critics who have read the paper told me to take it out, and I will. It's not a good thing. It's not a good statement. Moroni digging up the record over and over again. It was an affectation. But I do believe that the Book of Mormon does represent a victory of art over life. That, as I said, I think that you have here a work of literary artistry, and that it ought to be examined in more depth. But that piece of artistry is a victory where the entire Nephite and Lamanite civilizations fell and came to ruin. And it's a lasting piece of victory of art over life, in the same sense that you know, that the Old and the New Testament are also victories of art over life. To me, the scriptures are an unending chronology of human failure. And I see, and as you can see in my closure there, I see an existential vision. Camilla Williams said in her discussion of my paper, is an existential vision a requirement of the class? And I say, you know, it's not a requirement for you if you want to believe in a beatific vision. But in terms of human experience, I think that we are largely abandoned. I mean, that's the way that free agency works. If God were constantly intruding and entering into people's lives and tell them how to be, to pluck them out of unfortunate situations, then agency would not exist.
Yeah. You go ahead.
If you want to discuss that, I just have another question. Considering that the entire New Testament...
Can I be here?
Considering that the entire New Testament covers a period of perhaps 50 years, on a conservative estimate,
okay,
and that it was composed sort of after the fact, would you compare your analysis of the Book of Mormon with the prominence given in the New Testament to proclamation, and the downgrading of the close reading of the text engaged in by the Pharisees?
Well, excuse me, can I get you to answer the question in the mic?
Oh, does it work?
Yeah. Yeah.
Indeed.
I think that different things are happening at different periods in time, you know, and sometimes the speech act is important, and sometimes the written word is important. So I think it would depend upon the period. If you take a specific 50-year period, like, you know, in the Book of Mormon, probably you'd have to focus on a shorter period of time. When people were doing the kind of inappropriate reading that you're mentioning, which was condemned in the New Testament, then I think that you would see an ascendancy of the oral tradition. You know, but Christ, of course, was operating subversively within his religious culture, speaking outside of, you know, the locus of power, and speaking out on the hillside, speaking to the multitudes, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount. So this was a subversive oral tradition, and of course, most biblical scholars agree that what we have in the New Testament is largely, especially in the Gospels, is largely a collection of oral narratives, which were sometime later transformed into written texts. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I'm not sure that...
Can I pursue something that's in a close vein, and that is in terms of the literary claims that we're making? Your argument leads us to this is a very literary way of looking at the Book of Mormon, and that puts real literary pressure on it. I have deep respect for the Book of Mormon. My religious faith is founded in it, but I fail really to see the literary excellences of the book as clearly as you do. And I want to lead you into that, set you up really as kind of straight man, because I want to see those. I hear it speaking low out of the dust, but I don't have the horror movie effect that you do. To me, the dust is boredom on the book. I think that's true for a lot of us in our culture, to be very frank. I think 9 out of 10 Mormons reading the book at any given time are asleep. We save millions of dollars in the church sleeping pills by reading the Book of Mormon. We simply are not seeing, in a practical sense, the literary excellences that you see, and I want you to help us with it. For example, a specific, and this is where I thought your question was leading, although it went in a little different direction. You suggest that the Book of Mormon's ellipsis, compression, and conflation are often mistaken for prolixity. Well, that's exactly what I'm mistaken for. In a compression contest with the Bible, the Book of Mormon, in my judgment, would come in about third in that contest. A comparison of Genesis 1, for example, with 1 Nephi in terms of concentration. Fully 5% of 1 Nephi, I just counted them up before I came this morning, is "and it came to passes." Mark Twain may have estimated a little high, but you can see what he means when he says if he'd left it came to passes out, his Bible would have been only a pamphlet. It just isn't as concentrated. I'm in modern British literature. Yeah, but love the Bible. Teach you that. Listen to this. "I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, therefore I was taught somewhat in all the learning of my father, and having seen many afflictions in the course of my days, nevertheless having been highly favored of the Lord in all my days, yea, having had a great knowledge of the goodness and the mysteries of God, therefore I make a recording of my proceedings in my days." It just falls something short of "in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth." I'd like better "I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents and having been highly favored of the Lord, record my days." I would lean toward that as an editor. I edit on the side. How about that? What I'm really asking is what kind of book is this? We're saying it is not a novel, and I think you're absolutely right in that. The problem people have always had with the Book of Mormon is that it is a terrible novel. Let's see what it is. We're seeing what it is. It's not a novel. It's not a literary hoax. It's not. Is it an apology? That's the one suggestion you made. How do you see this book? Literarily, what is it structurally, and wherein lie its excellences?
Well, I think that the Book of Mormon is a collection of texts, and you have different kinds of texts. It's like if you've taken history classes, you buy books which are collections of documents from a period, and those documents reveal the nature of what is going on in people's minds, philosophically, religiously, artistically, at a given period in time. And I think that what you have here, as I said, is a collection of texts which aren't not put together in what we would normally think of as a very coherent or cohesive order, largely because our perception of how things should be has been infected and influenced by Jamesian aesthetics of what constitutes a good novel. And if you look at this thing as a novel, it's a terrible novel. And as that one critic said, it's not a novel at all, according to any literary critic. But I think that's true. Look at the Solomon manuscript, which some people say is one of the sources of the Book of Mormon. There you have an excellent statement or an excellent presentation of what a literary hoax, a contemporary literary hoax, would look like. Let me read you something here from my notes. I have heard, there's a fad. Speaking of fads right now, there's the fad that the Book of Mormon is a product of the 19th century. I have heard this assertion about the Book of Mormon, but I have not yet seen the case argued convincingly in detail by a competent literary critic. It's coming from historians. That is to say, by one qualified to judge. some chauvinism here. The Book of Mormon's break with history is representative of the church's break with history. It is a repudiation of secular history and the insistence of a new thing under the sun. Literary criticism is intensely involved with the study of genres and conventions. But the Book of Mormon has nothing to do with conventions, at least not those of Western European English civilization. Where, for example, is the love story? Where is the poetry, the songs, the sagas in iambic pentameter like you see in the fraudulent Ossian epic? Unlike Melville's Pierre, Joseph Smith had not conned or learned his novel lessons. Where are the literary allusions to Shakespeare, Milton, the classical writers, or anyone else for that matter? Where are the ghosts and castles and other Gothic apparatus? Where is the romantic idealism? Where is the unified point of view? Spalding's manuscript, on the other hand, gives you exactly the kind of book you would expect given the dominant conventions of the time. The problem people have had with the Book of Mormon is that it is a terrible novel, or more properly, in terms of American literature, a terrible romance. So we have this collection of things. Since our time is short,
I'd refer you to Lewis Midgley's article, review review of books on the Book of Mormon, published by Farms, which addresses many of these same questions that you're raising. It's the review of McConkie and Millett's doctrinal commentary, in which he talks about exactly the questions that you're raising.
A final note, and that's exactly what it is. You've pointed out to us that Nephi and the other storytellers of the Book of Mormon understood the necessity of turning experience into a story if they were to face and survive the horrible truth implicit in it. You also point out to us, I think in direct contradiction, that if we read the Book of Mormon for its stories, for the plot, it will be nothing to us but a book of stories for children, rather than the kind of profound and perhaps horrific cultural confrontation that we look for. In other words, we ought to read it as stories. In other words, we ought not to read it as stories. And if that's what you're saying, I heartily applaud, because I think it ought to be read in both ways. We are well advised to approach the Book of Mormon both in terms of story and not in terms of larger cultural concerns.
Yeah, stories for children.
Yeah. And what story is it is a real issue that your paper raises but does not conclude. And that's something we ought to think about. You're talking about the Book of Mormon really as apocalypse, and that's a very interesting kind of idea, because at the same time, it is one of the most horrible stories of the ending that I know of. It's an apocalypse. Usually an apocalypse is a kind of prediction, and you can say, well, maybe it really won't happen, as in the Book of Revelation. But this is not just a prediction of the end of the world. This is a description of its already having occurred, an end of the Nephi world. That's really horrific. But if anyone were to ask me, on the other hand, in direct contradiction again, what the real power of the Book of Mormon is, I would say that in the face of that kind of gloomy, horrific attitude, that the essence of the book lies in something like, if Adam fell, men might be, and men are, that they might have joy. That an optimism that runs directly contradictory to that. I think you've stirred up some things that we'll want to think about for a long time. I appreciate you having done it, Fred. Thank you.